This is the Aftermarket Radio Network.
Welcome to another episode of Business by the Numbers. I'm your host, Hunt Demarest, CPA with Parmelis & Associates. So, it's been a little while since we've done this, but got a special episode this week of listener questions. We like to call it our mailbox episodes. Some of these were asked once, and a couple of these I had numerous requests over the last couple of weeks or in real life, so we're going to talk about it. So this week, we're going to look at three entirely different questions that didn't each need their own episode, but if they asked it, some of you are probably wondering them too. Before we get into that, I just want to stop and thank you to the rest of the dedicated listeners. Remember, if you want your question answered on here, just like these listener questions this week, shoot me an email at podcast@parmelis.com. Want to talk to me about accounting and tax services that Parmelis can offer to your auto repair shop? Shoot me a text at 301-307-5413. And lastly, but not leastly, we cannot forget our dedicated sponsors. If you need to hire the next rock star for your team, give Promotive a call. If you're looking for a full-service staffing solution that does everything from sourcing, qualifying, creating job descriptions, scheduling interviews, to negotiating job offers, Promotive is your answer. Visit them online at gopromotive.com. This first one that we're going to talk about this week, I am going to give, I believe Mark was the one that asked me about this one. So special thanks to Mark for asking about warranty work. Warranty work, or how you record warranty work, is and often talked about, often argued about, and also something that we have covered before. If you want to learn the ins and outs and you want to hear a full 35-minute, 40-minute episode on internal work, how to book internal warranty work, all of that, go back and listen to episode 45. Really weird to think about. I'd be curious of how that sounds. We are on episode 172. So yeah, that was over 2 years ago. The process procedure has not changed. So that one is timeless. Let's go into the basics of this. If you want to hear the full ins and outs of why we're even talking about this or what it's related to, go listen to that episode. But the general idea behind it is this. Let's say that I have a job that comes in. My technician is going to spend 10 hours on that job, and it's a warranty job. If I close that out as a zero ticket, my financials, my QuickBooks is going to look the same as if I didn't do any work for that 10 hours. But I wasn't paid for that 10 hours, so it's not going to be reported in my labor sales. Neither is parts, right? A lot of stuff is not going to be in there. What that does is immediately has a disconnect between what your business is actually doing and what the numbers look like. That makes us lose accuracy. It makes us lose kind of management usefulness. It just really kind of skews a lot of different things. You also don't know what your cost of your warranty is, right? How much did you spend on warranty? How much time or opportunity cost did you have by your team working on your internal vehicles, warranty work, and not a retail customer? So what we advise is really two different things. If you have a warranty job, and let's say NAPA is going to reimburse you the full amount. So let's say that you go to NAPA and say, I did this ticket and I'm going to do my warranty work at full retail because it's worked just like anything else. I send that to NAPA. NAPA says, great, here's your $1,000 for your $1,000 ticket. The first example on how to do warranty work is it's going to look exactly like retail. If the company is going to pay you your retail or your door rate on this, the transaction looks exactly the same. Make a ticket for it, get a payment for it, deposit the ticket, close out the ticket. Done, easy enough. I will argue that the other side of this is almost just as easy. If they aren't going to pay you anything, you still put the ticket through as full retail, and then most people pay this off with a fake credit card called warranty work, in-house payment, or something like that. What happens on QuickBooks is if you don't get paid, we still have the full $1,000 reported as sale. We have all of our labor and parts costs, if we have any. And then down underneath expenses, that same $1,000 comes back out as an expense. So we have a $1,000 sale, $1,000 expense. All we're left over with is the labor and parts costs, right? It's the exact same idea as zeroing the entire ticket out. But this way, we're not skewing the sales and we're looking at the true opportunity cost. Why are we talking about this now? What was Mark's question? Mark had a good question. And one, Mark, if you knew, I deliberately did not cover on episode because it's a little bit of a tricky one. But Hunt, what the heck happens when something in between happens? If I went to NAPA and let's say the NAPA will pay me $500 of my $1,000, how do I do that? You didn't address that situation. I know what happens if I have someone paying like a customer. I know what happens if they stiff me completely, but I got kind of a mixture of the two. more or less, if you have a mixture of the two, you are going to have a mixture of the two as far as how you close out this ticket. So if you have, let's say Napa sent you a check and they say, we are going to pay you $543.63, then I'm going to post $543.63 and I'm going to still have what? $435 outstanding in my shop management software. That is now my warranty expense. So remember, if Napa pays for the entire amount, your warranty expense is going to be zero because there was no expense. They footed the entire bill. If Napa pays for none of it, your warranty expense is going to be $1,000. It's all on you. But what happens in between is your warranty expense is going to be in between. And we see this a lot. So generally, our warranty expense is what our warranty expense is, the true opportunity cost of it, less whatever credits we get. Most people do not do your full door rate, full markup in all of this. Some of them don't even reimburse for labor. Some of them reimburse for labor at a discounted amount. But the ultimate solution for things like that is going to be a blended solution between the two. If you have something where the vendor doesn't want to give you a check and instead they want to do a parts credit on it, it really gets kind of a little bit more complicated. If you have a good bit of this, these vendors technically have to give you a check. And it really makes it easier if you say, hey, if I give you a warranty, I just want to check on that. Don't blend in with the other stuff. But essentially, if they're just going to give you a credit on your bill, most of my clients still close us out all the warranty expense on it. And then when they get that credit on that bill, instead of booking that credit as a credit for parts cost, we're really going to book it as a credit for warranty cost. So if you're getting paid on it, it goes in like normal. If you're not getting paid on it, full warranty. If they're going to pay part with a check, pay part with a write-off, we're going to do it accordingly. And if they're only paying you with a statement credit or bill credit, it's going to be treated just like they're paying you nothing. And when we get that credit, it's going to lower down our warranty expense. If we were to look at this, we're going to have $1,000 in warranty expense, and then they give us our $600 credit on the invoice. We book that against warranty expense. Now warranty expense is $400. I shot you an email, Mark, kind of explained that one. Hopefully that made sense for you. And I know for other people that haven't listened to that episode, this will be very important after you go back and listen to it. So if you haven't listened to Warranty Work on episode 45, internal work on it, I really, really recommend it. Not to brag, but it's one of my better ones just because it is such an often asked question on it. And also, like, there is some intricacies to this, right? I spent 4 minutes kind of explaining that. Episode 45, I think I spent 45 minutes. So check it out. Question number one about warranty work. Mark, I hope you got your question answered on that. And if you guys have any more questions about warranty work on it, shoot them over. I think that kind of covers it. But if there's other things, there's other gaps on that other one or other unique situations, let me know. I do this stuff so that you guys can learn. I do this stuff so that you guys can understand your business more and hopefully make more money. And I'm always looking for ideas. So if I hit it on the head, cool, we're done. If not, shoot me some emails and we'll do another episode on that. So next question, I don't know if I really give any credit on this one. This is like what I was talking about. I've had this same question for whatever reason, like 4 times in the last 3 weeks. But the general gist of this has to do with a husband or a wife calling me up, either starting their business, changing their business, doing something, but they say, hey, I want to have my spouse on the business. I will tell you the first one, just because someone asked me about this specific use case on it is, does it help me to have my business owned majority by a minority or a minority / woman owned business? So there's something called an 8A certification. It has to do with a certification through the federal government that you are a business that is just that, either owned by a minority, owned by a woman, or owned by a woman minority. What the 8A certification process is it's essentially a certification process to prove that you are a minority-owned business, a woman-owned business, or some combination of the two. In the government contracting world, any of you that have dabbled in this, you know that that 8A certification is probably worth its weight in gold. If you have 5 government contractors go to the same job and it has 8A kind of set-asides on it, if one of those is 8A, they are going to get that. It doesn't last forever, but if you're looking at this in the government contracting world, it is extremely, 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 extremely common to have a spouse on there as the owner, even if they are not the actual one doing this, and sometimes even an unrelated person just to get that status. That being said, does it make sense for your automotive repair shop to put your spouse on there for the sole intention of getting these contracts, being minority-owned business, being woman-owned business? It does not. I've had one client over the years. I've been doing this, I think it was officially my 15-year anniversary last week of doing this, but I've been doing it part-time for a little bit longer than that. Over all the years, I had one client that did this. They were not an automotive client, right? It's like one of the small percentage of non-automotive clients. They were very, very specialized, and they were specifically going after government contracts. Not only did they go and get it, they spent a massive amount of money to get this, but it paid for itself. It is a bigger process than just saying, hey, my wife is going to own it, even though she has nothing to do with it. I'm going to get all these contracts. Could you get a local contract because of it? Could you get a municipality contract because of it? Maybe. But again, generally, I have not seen that be a reason to add your spouse to the business. And again, if you are a woman and you own it 100% on it, there is never any downside to having a woman own it or a man own it. But again, generally, it's just not something that we see much benefit for. And as we'll talk about in a second, there is some downsides. Hunt, if I was thinking about this, and this is not directed towards a man or a woman, this is just legally married. So either side of this is, what is my benefit? So let's say that both of us work in the business or both of us don't work in the business. Does it make any difference on how you're going to explain this? And it really doesn't. Whether you are a man that owns a shop and your wife works there full time with you, or she never steps foot in the door, or we flip this around, you're a woman that owns a shop and your husband doesn't work in there at all, then it doesn't really matter. This is not a sexist thing. I only want one of you guys on there, and I don't really care which one of you guys it is. The reason is because you're already legally married and most of this stuff is treated as 50-50 anyways. So like I said, if we only want to see really one versus the other, we don't really have a benefit on which one it is, then why do we want to put someone on there? What are the benefit that we're trying to get by putting this person on there? And generally what I see is generally on the spouse that does not have ownership percentage on there, they want to see their name on there to make sure that they have their assets and interests protected. Hey, Steve owns the 100% of this. If I was to divorce him on this, I don't want him to get all of it. I want to be on there 50-50. And again, I'm not a lawyer. Consult with your lawyer. And this changes by state. But in most states, if you're a community property state, whatever your spouse owns, especially if it was purchased after your marriage, you own too, whether it says it or not. And even if you are not in a community property state on this and you have a basic estate set up, that's generally how people do this. If you want your spouse to get everything when you pass away, a lot of times that is the default and you don't even need to do anything, but generally it's pretty quick and easy to do. So again, if you're trying to get the benefit, when I say, what is the benefit? If you're like, Hunt, if something were to happen, you want to make sure that she gets on there, right? Or hey, if something happens to me, Hunt, I want to make sure he gets on there. Don't do it like this. You are trying to fix a problem with a very strange solution. And again, we're going to talk about here in 1 minute, there is some downsides to this. Get it set up through your lawyer. Get it set up through your estate. Do not do it by just putting a K-1 on there. It'll achieve the same result, but as we're going to talk about here in a second, there is some downsides. What are the downsides to this? So best case scenario, whether you guys are on there or not, for most businesses, it really doesn't matter. But these are some of the things that I've seen on the downside of this. Let's say that you go out and you guys have the best opportunity to expand your business, to buy another location, to buy something, whatever. You go out, you spend a bunch of money, and things go south and you are up a creek. Or maybe you go out and you pay a bunch of payroll taxes and you forget to send that to the government. And now the government is trying to put you in jail. Unfortunately, I'm kind of saying these tongue in cheek. These are legitimate real things that have happened. If you and your spouse are both on there, you are probably both on the hook. If they have two people on the hook, they are not letting either one of you off the hook until they get their money, their tax, whatever. If it is just you, and your spouse even had something to do with the business, but they are not on as ownership in any way, shape, or form on it. Yeah, the business has issues. You probably have some issues. Your spouse has nothing to do with it. I'm not going to say it's super common. I'm not going to say that it is advisable, but I would say at least a dozen of our clients are second go-arounds of businesses that are operating under the same name. But the first go-around, the spouse owned it. Something happened. That spouse got their credit ruined, their bankruptcy ruined, everything ruined. And now magically the next day, the business reappears in the same location, same name, but the other spouse owns it. There is some opportunity. You guys both have your own credit. And I have some people where their one spouse's credit is so bad that they're not on any paperwork. And it wasn't always like that. Another thing on this is we're talking about going and getting the IRS chasing after us. What about if you are talking about a bank? And I'm not talking just about the business. Right? The business has its own guarantees as well. But generally, if you go to the SBA, if you're an owner on the business and over a certain percentage on this, the SBA wants a personal guarantee. Again, you and your spouse probably own most of the stuff together. If they have a personal guarantee, it's going to make it a lot harder for you to get some stuff out. But what do you think that the bank has more power? If they have a personal guarantee on one of the spouses or both? And again, you might be saying, well, hon, I'm not sure that there's a downside. You can't argue with me that there is an upside to that. There are sometimes rules that benefit the owner, right? And we'd like to utilize those rules accordingly. There's sometimes that rules that penalize the owner or kind of benefit the employees. And if you have both family members playing both of those roles, we can leverage that. There's some stuff on health insurance and reimbursements that we'd like to do on the officer side. You can't really do that as an employee. So some of the benefits that we give to the husband, because we're treating them like an owner, is not the same thing that we're going to do to the wife, or we're going to treat them like an employee. Again, it's all going to the same place. It's all flowing to the same tax return, but you have two different classifications there. And again, we can use that to our advantage sometimes.
Is your recruitment process draining your valuable time and resources? What if there was a partner who could take your recruitment efforts off your plate? Look no further. Promotive is your ultimate solution for hassle-free staffing focused solely on the automotive industry. On the web at gopromotive.com. Promotive understands the challenges you face when searching for the perfect technician or service advisor for your shop. That's why we've developed a platform that takes the hassle out of recruiting. Michelle Tanzi from EuroClinic said, "I am a shop owner and recruiting new talent is so time-consuming. Promotive does the majority of the seeking and recruiting. They reach out to the candidates for you, and when they feel they are a good match for you and culture, they make the connection. They follow up throughout the interview process, and we make sure that the candidates are a good fit and the shop is a good fit for the candidates. I admire that they genuinely want both parties to win. They recruited and paired us with a solid B-Tech and Master Tech. Both left a dealership position and are still part of our team. We are very happy with the character and culture match, and both technicians have become valuable team members." Visit our website at gopromotive.com today and join the growing community of shop owners who have found their ideal team members with Promotive.
Lastly on here is if you have an LLC with one owner, right? And real estate is probably the most common one on here. If you have a piece of real estate, let's say it owns the shop, let's say it owns anything on it, and you are just one person, whether it's a husband, wife, or you only have one of you guys on there, it is going to be a schedule on your personal tax return. I don't know what our rates are, but we're talking a couple $100. It increases the cost of your personal tax return, but you're adding a couple pages to a 40 or 50 page return. If you have two owners in LLC, you are no longer a sole proprietor and you are no longer a 2-page return on a schedule of your personal taxes. If for whatever reason you wanted to make sure that your spouse felt better, wanted to make sure that, you know, all of this stuff was above board, wanted to make sure that you could try and get an 8A certification and you want to bring that other partner on there, you want to bring that spouse on there, what is the benefit? Right? I still don't see it. And I'll tell you what the downside is you're going to be paying Hunt and you're going to be paying Parmelis probably an extra $1,000 or $1,500 because we don't have an extra 2-page schedule that goes on your personal tax return. If you have more than one partner or two partners in an LLC, you're going to be firing a whole separate partnership tax return. Higher dollar amounts, you're going to be paying me more money, right? I'm not going to complain. If I'm going to say, why did you do this just to pay me more? Because we're paying the exact same taxes. There are some benefits. If you're thinking to yourself, well, Hunt, my partnership is owned by me and my wife already. There's reasons to do this. I wouldn't say that if you have it set up otherwise, there's probably a big advantage to go and get rid of that. And a lot of times you can't. But again, if you're sitting there saying, hey, I own all of this, my spouse owns all of this, should we start mixing it together? Short answer is probably not. This one is a bit of a downer one, right? And kind of goes along the same line, but is our last listener question of the week and has to do with divorce, child support, and stuff like that. I am happily married. This has nothing to do with me. This is not personal experience. Shout out to Kayla, my wife. We have been together now almost 20 years at this point. And I hope that we keep on going like that forever. Shout out to Kayla. Any of you that listen that know my wife, tell them Hunt said really nice things about her. And this is not about me planning my own divorce. Unfortunately, that being said, it has not been that smooth of a ride for a couple of my clients recently. And I've been dealing with more divorces than I've seen in a little while over the last couple of months. I probably have 3 or 4 divorces going on right now. And what I've learned out of that, what clients I think kind of go back and say, oh, I wish I would have known this before with divorce and child support is kind of what I'm going to share here now. This is not meant to replace a divorce attorney. This is not to advocate divorce or anything like that. But realistically, some of you guys listening to this might have to deal with it, whether you know it now or not. Some of you might be thinking about this right now, and this is very useful information. But honestly, I hope that this is not useful information to anyone, but maybe you can send it to a friend that is. I'm going to give you some quick facts, some quick tips, but this is state by state. So do not send me an email. Hunt, that's not how divorce works in my state. It's probably not. Don't send me an email. Well, Hunt, I'm going to do this. Can my divorce attorney ask for that? I don't know. Ask a divorce attorney. This is kind of real life tips and tricks and stuff like that that I've seen for my clients go through this. And sometimes just like kind of some high level advice on how I would approach this. First question I get a lot is, how much is my spouse going to get for the business? Number one question, oh, they're going to take half of everything. Again, I don't know how much they're going to take. And a lot of this depends on the state. How these rules are done, this is not a federal rule. These are all state. And depending on what state you're in, some of these are by county and even more specifically. Depending on what state you're in is how this is going to be treated. What do I mean by that? Don't ask your friend in Texas, how is divorce went if you're in Alabama? It's going to be different. Does that mean that if you ask someone else in the state that your divorce is going to be the exact same thing? No, but at least the state side will. It also depends on when you started your business. If you started your business 2 years after you and your spouse got married, do not ask someone what happened on their divorce when they got divorced and they had a premarital asset. If you started your business before you got married, in most states, there's different treatment than if you got married before you started the business. So the timing of this makes a big difference. How does that factor in? Use your brain. Generally, if you have this stuff before you get married, it's treated a lot differently than if you get it afterwards. Also, if you're married for a year, your spouse is going to be subject or entitled to much less than if you were married for 40 years. So it depends on the state. It depends on when you started your business. It depends on how long you've been together with your spouse. It depends on if your spouse works or not, because the courts are going to look at a divorce situation a lot differently if the husband and wife are both earning the same amount and there is a reasonable expectation that that's going to continue in the future. That is going to be treated a lot different than when one of the spouse works and the other one has never worked in their life. Okay, Hunt, but seriously, there's a lot of caveats on here. What does this generally end up looking like? Yeah, it depends on the state. It depends on where you started. It depends on if your spouse works or not. 95% of the situations on this, it works out kind of how you would expect. It all gets looped together and each of you guys gets half. Technically, a lot of states actually allow you to go both ways. When you have a buy-sell agreement in a divorce situation, you can sometimes exercise this both ways. It's not that common. I haven't really seen it ever done for a lot of reasons. But generally, if you go back and you say, I'm going to give you $800,000 for your business, you can generally say the same thing of, I don't really want it. So you're going to have to give me $800,000 for my business and you get to keep it. If your wife never worked in that business, doesn't know what to do, yeah, the courts aren't going to allow you to do that. You both work in the shop, you both do the same things, doesn't mean that one of you has to keep it versus the other ones. How does that value come up with? Short answer is not easily and not quickly. So most commonly what ends up happening is my client, whatever party it is, will usually try to ask me to do this and I will usually say, I'm not going to do it. Now, Hunt, why do you not like to do valuations for a divorce? First and foremost, they're not very fun to do. No one's in a good mood. Everyone's going to argue with me on it. And the end result is everyone's kind of losing on it. So they're just really not great to be around. Generally, lawyers aren't the best to deal with, and they can be a bit aggressive, especially depending on what side. Both of these lawyers want me to skew these numbers. I'm not interested in getting involved in any of that stuff. And more specifically on this, I generally say no to my clients because I say, whatever this number comes in high or low on it, I don't think that your spouse is going to take it because they know that I'm your account. Sometimes we'll do it, but almost always you're probably looking at two valuations. And even some of these situations, I tell my client, hey, go hire someone else to do this because the last thing I want is for you to pay me $5,000, $6,000, come with a valuation just for them to throw it out because they don't think I'm impartial. But general rule of thumb is one party goes and says it's worth $500,000. That's usually the one that's trying to buy the other person out. And the person getting bought out usually comes back and says it's worth $1.5 million. And then for the next 6 months to 6 years, they fight about it. Honestly, I'm, again, joking on this stuff. This is how this goes. the way that this generally works when this gets down to the end, right? I've seen this take 6 years, like I just kind of joked about. But this generally takes 6 months, 8 months to kind of come up with a reasonable solution here. But it usually ends up being pretty close to just 50% of the value. If you say that you have two valuations, just anytime that you have anything that you're kind of negotiating a price on, the farther away that you are, the harder it is to come to an agreement. In that situation where one came at 500, one came at 1.5 million, that business is probably worth $1 million right there in the middle. And these people are going to pay each of their lawyers hundreds of thousands of dollars to argue it just so they come to the ultimate same conclusion. If you are going to do this and you are serious about getting divorced and you don't want to spend the next couple years in courts, lawyer's office and stuff like this, give your spouse a fair offer. Give them a more than fair offer on this and stop thinking about, hey, this is what this is worth, and look about as this is what it's going to cost me to be done with that part of my life and move on. Your sanity is worth a lot more than this. Whether you like it or not, you're probably going to be paying that amount. And if you end up fighting over a year or two on this, you're going to get less money. Your spouse is going to get less money. And a lot of lawyers are going to get a ton of money. No one wins in a divorce. The lawyers are the only ones that ever win on this. So don't look for a win. Look for something that you can tolerate. Well, Hunt, I'm not interested in doing any of that. They're not going to get a cent of my business. I'm going to run this thing into the ground. And I don't want my husband to get a cent. I don't want my wife to get a cent, whatever it is. I love the thought process. And depending on the state, you might be able to do this. But almost all states have rules against this. You can't just run this stuff into the ground, even if it is a personal service business. But what's worse than giving your spouse $500,000 for a business that's worth $1 million would be to have a court find that you're trying to torpedo your own business, still give you a judgment for $500,000, but now you've ran that $1 million business into the ground. So if you want to go down with the ship, you can, but probably not going to avoid the bill. So last one on here, while we get into this really, really fun topic of divorce and child support, is a quick kind of thing on how child support works. So again, this is all state by state, and generally the state has a predetermined formula. And it's usually based on one of two things. And this is very, very, very important. So some states judge you based on what you show in income. Some states show you what you have in distributions. How much did you report in profit, or how much did you take out in cash? I'll give you the difference between the two. One of these you can control. One of these, I guess you can, but you probably don't want to. If you have a state that is going to make your child support, and it's generally a percentage, whatever your distributions are from your self-employed business, we get X percent for child support. So let's say your distributions were 100 grand, and that figure works out to be your annual child support's going to be 20 grand. If you are based on cash flow, you have the ability to change that. If you don't want to take money out of the business, if you want to make $1 million in the business, but leave it all in there, you could still have relatively low distributions. You're going to have to take money out, right? You're going to have to survive, but there is some games that you can play by just leaving the money in the business. Now, in a larger sense of this, if your kids are very young, at some point, you're probably going to want to use that money and spend it. So are you really going to plan on accumulating millions of dollars over the next 15 years just to not give a little bit more in child support? Don't shoot yourself in the foot to just try and get one over on your ex. That's a case in some states where you actually do have some planning opportunities. Most states are not like that. The example in Maryland is whatever your net income shows on your K-1, that's what you owe in child support. Shows that you made 200 grand, but you left it all in the business. Well, you better take some out, buddy, because you're paying 20% or whatever that is of it. Generally, it's a predetermined formula on this. The first year is always really weird to kind of figure out what it is because it's not the most straightforward. But generally, going forward on this, it's going to be pretty consistent. If your income is up, your child support's going to go up. If your income is down, you might be able to get your child support lowered. Not always the case. But generally, most states, they're allowed to go back and request increases. Yeah, 5 years down the road, if you're making more money, there's a chance, depending on the state, that your spouse can go and petition to get more child support. Hun, I like the idea of this, but again, I wasn't interested in giving my spouse any money for my business. I'm not interested in giving them any money for child support. So I'm just going to hide the money or not take as much. Again, you can't do this, guys. They're not stupid. They know that, hey, this guy made 300 grand, and all of a sudden after you got divorced, he's making $0. Yeah, I mean, this is getting close to the F word of fraud. Don't mess around with that. Plus, it's going to your kids. Just keep on saying it to yourself. It's probably not going to your kids, but hey, it's going to your kids. But there's also protections the other way on this. I currently have a client right now that is dealing with this where they are increasing their child support amount and his business is doing better every year that's gone on and his spouse is not working at all. So essentially, he's very frustrated because his child support is going up as he's working more, as he's doing more, and his ex-wife now is not working at all and is kind of going back and saying, hey, I need more money because I'm not working enough. I'm not going to get into specifics of that, but that's a no-no as well too. They are not going to reward someone to say, hey, you don't have any kids at home. There's no reason. You can't just make $5,000 a year on DoorDash and expect your ex to pay with you forever. If someone was a stay-at-home mom for 35 years, they're probably going to be able to do that. Again, this all comes down to how long you've been married and a lot of different things. What advice can I give you? I've already given you kind of a couple tips on that and how this stuff works, but my first word of advice on is don't get divorced. If you want to try to avoid all of this stuff, don't get divorced. And if you are going to get divorced, then just be prepared. It's going to suck. It's going to be miserable. You're going to spend a bunch of money. You're not going to be happy and neither is your ex. So if you go in with that in mind on it, then you probably won't be surprised. But I've never seen someone win a divorce that wasn't an attorney. And I swear to you on that, that is 100% true. These cases generally take 2 years and they end up with a very similar dollar figure that my client probably offered or the spouse probably offered years before that. But instead of taking that, we now got legal battles, hundreds of thousands of legal fees, all to get the same thing. You want to be done with this, offer a fair amount and be done with it. Your sanity is worth much more than that. And like I said, you're going to end up giving this to a lawyer anyways. And also the child support. Just like I told my client the other day, you're going to be subject to child support for years. So again, if you want to, yeah, purposefully work less, charge less, but everyone loses. You're making less money. Your spouse is making less money. Your kids are going to get less money. Your employees are making less money and your customers are probably getting a worse experience. You're trying to start a new chapter in your life. The last thing that you want is this new chapter where you're just kind of trying to meter everything just to get one over on someone. If you want to do it again, fine. But if you're going to do that, be careful because you might torpedo your business and still have the same exact bill. So thanks again to all the shop owners that posed these questions. I hope that was helpful for you, or I hope that it honestly wasn't for all of you. Then you never have to use this advice for divorce or child support. As always, please share with friends. If you have any questions, comments, or ideas for a future episode, shoot me an email at podcast@parmelis.com. Just want to say thanks again for listening on the Aftermarket Radio Network. You can find all shows on the aftermarketradionetwork.com, on your favorite podcast listing apps. So thanks again for joining me on Business by the Numbers. Stay safe out there, and I will talk to you all next week.
You've been listening to Business by the Numbers with Hunt Demarest on the Aftermarket Radio Network. Follow Hunt on your favorite podcast listening app. Let him know what you'd like him to cover. His email is in the show notes. Hunt is all for advancing the aftermarket.